I was talking about dullness earlier. I made no distinction between what we call subtle dullness and the strong dullness, which is sleepiness. And so there's really two fairly distinct kinds of dullness. So I think what we were talking about earlier, I think what Adam was referring to is the strong form of dullness that is as you're beginning to descend into sleep, becoming drowsy. And you say that you're not sure if you have encountered that yet. It's possible that you haven't. And some people seem to be more prone to it than others.
That I have. I mean, sometimes I've noticed that I seem to be nodding off. But that wasn't... But I thought there must be more to it than that.
Yeah, well there is. The nodding off, the drowsiness, that's the strong dullness. But there is a subtle form of dullness. And that's... which subtle dullness typically becomes strong dullness. But sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes subtle dullness can just remain, just be sustained at a particular level. So you do have to come to recognize it and to overcome it. Let me just say a little bit more about strong dullness, and then you can, and then I can talk about the kind of sustained subtle dullness. I think everybody has sometime or another paid attention to what happens to themselves when they become drowsy and sleepy, right? Mm-hmm. So you know that whatever you happen to be paying attention to becomes unclear. You lose clarity, and over time you're no longer following the thread of what's happening. Whether you're driving a car or watching a television program or reading a page in a book or, you know, whatever it is, with the onset of sleepiness, whatever it is we're perceiving loses its clarity. And then something else happens. It begins to be distorted. And, well, the loss of clarity is itself a distortion. But the other thing that's very distinctive as dullness is developing is that your mind begins to make associations that they're more free, random associations. So, you know, if you're watching your breath, your mind will associate that pattern with waves, for example, or anything else that you can think of that somehow resembles, in one way or another, the pattern of what you're experiencing, you know, and it can take different forms. Like, of course, the relationship between waves and breath is an obvious one. And so you might start to have this distortion, like you're in a boat or you're hearing waves at the seashore or something like that. On the other hand, you might have been practicing trying to notice some distinct point in the cycle of the breath. And so the association your mind makes might be with some other periodical phenomenon that has some distinct element to it, you know, like it could be auditory or visual or anything else like that. So looking for the beginning and the end of the breath can become like, it can take on this sort of dreamlike imagery that you're looking at different colored lights flashing in alternation or something. You know what I mean? So your mind is making associations. Of course, this happens when you're falling asleep, too. This happens when you're dreaming. When you dream, the mind, rather than its usual sort of linear, logical, rule-following way of following a process or constructing something, starts to do it in a more lateral way, by this resembles that, you know, A is to B is C is to D kind of thing, and you come up with all these really weird dreamlike images that have some vague resemblance to whatever it was you were paying attention to, but they're really not it at all. Does everybody follow what I'm talking about there? This is common in dreams, this is common just as we're falling asleep, and this is common when you're sitting in meditation and dullness begins to develop. When you're falling asleep, these images that come up, these weird distorted images, dreamlike images, those are called hypnagogic images. And the word just means that they happen as you're falling asleep, hypnagogic. And the other part of that is when you have distorted images when you wake up in the morning that are like the remnants of your dream process, those are called hypnopompic, you know. Not that you care about these words, but hypnopompic.
Yeah. And what does that mean?
That is the counterpart when you're waking up, when you also have dream-like... Actually, when you're waking up, it's more likely to feel like pieces of your dream being carried over into the process of waking. So, you know, you may open your eyes momentarily, glance at the clock, you know, but you're still partly dreaming.
So it's on the way up.
Yeah.
Good, thank you.
And these terms are important, but what's significant is that in the transition from being fully normally awake to being asleep, we have the same kind of thing going on in our minds that we do in dreams, which is the mind works far more on the basis of associations and resemblances and similarities and correspondences and pattern between one thing and another. So your mind is reminded by this pattern of some other pattern, and then it juxtaposes the two. And of course, in dreams, it'll make a little story around it. When you're sitting in meditation, it doesn't necessarily do that. But if it does, what it means is you're starting to get even more deeply into the state of dullness. You're moving towards actually falling asleep. Another thing that you'll notice when you're falling asleep is that your thoughts lose their coherence. They lose their thread, right? And, of course, that's the way it is in dream experiences, too. You know, you're one place, talking to one person, and you turn around and you're in a totally different place. It doesn't have that coherence. And another thing that happens when you're falling asleep, once again, it's similar to dreams, and that also happens when dullness comes on in meditation, is that there are gaps in your short-term memory. You know, if you're in the middle of the thought when you're falling asleep, you have the end of the thought, but you can't remember what the beginning was. You have that experience?
Yes. Right.
And, you know, you'll have the same thing when dullness is coming on your meditation. It's like all of a sudden you're aware of the sensation, but you don't know where you are in the cycle. You don't know your in-breath or out-breath or beginning or end. And then very quickly your mind puts it all together. But it's the same thing. There's these little gaps, little short circuits that, you know, you lose the continuity and the connection. So what we talk about dullness is actually very directly related to what happens in the process of falling asleep and then in dreaming. Now, so that's strong dullness. When strong dullness comes on, you find the fuzziness of perception, it's not very clear, a feeling of heaviness, sinking, which is like what happens when you're falling asleep, distorted, hypnagogic kind of imagery which can involve your meditation object, but then it can keep skirting sideways till it's totally unrecognizable. The gaps in your ability, you know, the little mini short circuits or gaps in your awareness of the breath. It's all in the same process. So, you know, strong dullness is just like falling asleep. Probably involves exactly the same things happening in your brain. That's happening when you fall asleep. Yes?
What you're describing is really familiar. Like tonight, when I was focusing on my breath as the meditation object, I swim, and you know, the getting a breath and then blowing it out in the water, I mean, my mind went to that.
Yes.
And then my mind went to just the pleasant sensation of buoyancy,
floating
water. Mm-hmm. And then, so I'm wondering, do you have a suggestion for staying out of that, or should I choose another meditation option?
No, well, you've described a very typical kind. This is exactly how this dullness manifests. And you don't need a different meditation object. It wouldn't do any good. You see, your mind would behave the same way with anything that you were trying to meditate on. As it starts to undergo these changes, you know, it's going to do the same thing. And that's a perfect example. Yeah, you can see the associations there. Breathing while you're swimming, and the motion of swimming, and then the water. And that's the other thing about dullness, is it has this very soft, warm, comfortable, inviting feeling to it. And that's one of the things that I didn't mention. We were talking about dealing with dullness earlier, but you know, you have this feeling of you'd much rather surrender to the dullness than to pull yourself out of it. When you pull yourself out of it, it's shocking, it's painful, it's, you know, it's like dumping cold water over your head or something, right? It's like, I don't really want to do that. So what was happening there is your mind was putting all these associations together, and the soft, floating, comfortable, everything. That's exactly how it happened. Now what you want to do, that's a classic example of dullness coming up. What you want to do is, as soon as you recognize it, find a way to wake yourself up. Just bring, and it doesn't matter, meditation object has nothing to do with it. It's that your brain is starting to put itself to sleep. And so what you need to do is wake yourself up. And that's what I was talking about earlier with Adam. And there are different things which I won't go into a lot of details on, but clenching your muscles, taking deep breaths. If you need to, stand up, meditate standing up. If you need to, go to the bathroom, splash cold water on your face, go sit down again. You know, whatever you need to do, but wake yourself up. And do this as many times as you need to until you've conditioned your brain and your mind to stop doing that for a while. Okay? Yeah. That's a very good example. Now, most of the time, people don't necessarily recognize dullness at that stage. And here's a very interesting thing. Noticing dullness at the stage that I described requires a heightened degree of awareness. When people begin to meditate, they go through that, but they don't realize they're in dullness until they experience the Zen lurch. Muscles lose tone. This is also part of going to sleep, is that all your postural muscles lose their tone. And so the body gradually sinks down, and then at some point, what happens is it starts to move and it'll stretch a muscle, and there's something called the muscle stretch reflex. If you stretch a muscle, you know, it's like when you hit the tendon in the knee, the leg kicks out. That's a muscle stretch reflex. And that's what the Zen lurch is. You've actually reached the point in falling asleep that now the motor systems of your body are all inhibited, and your body goes like that, and then it stretches a muscle. The stretch reflex happens at the spinal cord level, so it doesn't matter that up at this level everything's been shut off. The stretch reflex will happen. And when the stretch reflex happens, the Zen lurch wakes you up. And you say, "Ah, I was falling asleep." You know. And you say, so the teacher says, "Okay, try to notice the dullness earlier." So now you'll notice it. Oh yeah, I'm okay. You notice it before the Zen lurch. You notice the sagging and the sleep. But then, now what's happened is you've still gone through the stage of losing clarity and hypnagogic distortion. But because you've lost memory and because you haven't trained your mindful awareness, you forgot about it. You didn't identify it as important. No part of all the different parts of your mind identified this as something important. So it sort of slipped right by without you noticing. But then the meditation teacher says, try to notice the dullness as soon as you can. So now you're sitting there, and even before you start to sag down, you start noticing, oh, well, it's like I'm having these little mini dreams. My breath just became riding a bicycle. How did that happen? You notice things like that. Now you're becoming aware of it earlier. And then you keep watching and trying to catch it early. And then you find that it's just, the breath just gets really distant and fuzzy and unclear. And you know that the dullness is coming on. That happens before the associational distortions sort of set in. And so, and then there is actually a very, very subtle stage in the dullness where you still are aware, especially you've been practicing for a while, watching the breath, you've come to really recognize all the different stages of the breath cycle and the way those sensations manifest. And so they're still all there, and you're still aware of them, but you come to realize that they don't have the same vividness that they did before. You know, it's just they're very, very slightly out of focus, and that is the onset of dullness. So subtle dullness is these early stages, and as I say, usually it's a progression. It starts off subtle dullness, and then it gets stronger and stronger, you know, until right to the drowsiness and falling asleep. But there is a certain point that you can become sustained at. Or actually, there's a certain range in the early dullness which can be sustained. You can, for example, where everything is still present in your observation of the breath, but it's like it's a little bit from a distance and maybe just a little bit out of focus. Like it's a very relaxed perception. You know what I mean? You experience that? Just, it's very relaxed. That can be sustained. And that's actually, if you have a lot going on in your mind, that's a good place to be. Because if you try to focus in on the breath too tightly, then you're more likely to, and there's a lot of thoughts taking place, you're more likely to be caught by one of them. And you know, it just makes your mind even more agitated, maybe produces a, trying to focus too close can produce some monkey mind, or the mind just starts getting more and more hyper and agitated, and it flits over to this for a moment, it flits over to that, and it grabs onto this, and it comes back. And you know, you're not losing the breath, but you can just feel your mind is getting less and less stable. When that happens, if you can just back away, let go just a little bit out of focus, and stay there, then it becomes much easier. You don't have so much monkey mind, things like that. So that sustained subtle dullness, it can be useful. You can sustain the dullness when it becomes a little bit stronger as well, where it starts to feel very comfortable. And what you'll notice at that point, not only is the breath now kind of distant and out of focus, but your mind's starting to get real quiet. There's not nearly as many, you know, thoughts and other sensations. And this is where it becomes very deceptive, because you say, oh, I feel really good, and my mind's staying right on the meditation object. I guess, wow, this must be good concentration, and this is that meditative joy they talk about. And it's not really. It's good concentration, but it's concentration supported by dullness. Because as your mind becomes more and more dull, it has less and less capacity to entertain all these other thoughts and sensations. And so, yeah, your mind gets quieter. Your mind gets quieter as you start to fall asleep. So that can be sustained. And usually that level of subtle dullness is not, well, if your mind is tending to be very agitated and you had a lot of trouble, and you can sustain that level of dullness without being misled by its nature for a little while, that's not a bad trade-off. And you can use that as a balance. But we're moving into more and more risky territory. The next stage is you get a little deeper in the subtle dullness, where the mind starts free associating. And now you start to have these images come. Usually the feeling that's associated now, the pleasantness, has gotten very, very strong. And there will be an emotional feeling, like, it's really a dream feeling. It's the feeling that these images that are rising in your mind, they're really important. It's like, I'm just on the verge of understanding something really important. There's some significant message that is just some great insight that's about to appear to me. You're nodding your head. Any other of you had this experience of dullness? Yes, you've had that experience. There is that, and do you recognize it from dreams? Like in the dreams where there's something really important here, I could just grasp it. And these images are coming up. They're hypnagogic images, they're associational images, and maybe they do have some great importance. Who knows? That's not the point. The point is that you can sustain this state, and you can become very fascinated with these images that come up. You can, I think that you could probably act as a channel for other beings and spirits in this state. It is exactly the state. I used to do a lot of shamanic practices. I learned that a couple of decades ago, and used to do shamanic practices with the drums. You use a drum to enter into exactly that state. Your mind begins to move into the imaginal realm. And then it can bring up very interesting images, and you can even carry on conversations with the beings that you have contact with in these imaginal realms. And that may be all, that may be very wonderful if that's the kind of practice you're doing. But if you're doing meditation practice and you start to have these interesting visions and images arise, they're not what the practice is about. All they are is you're sustaining yourself. You're managing to sustain your brain and your mind on that borderline between the fully aroused waking state and the dream state. And I strongly suspect that in our dream state, we are open to and can connect with other minds, other consciousness, or maybe some, like Jung described, a collective unconscious, or, you know, there are prophetic dreams, there are big dreams with quite unusual features. I wouldn't be at all surprised, and as a matter of fact, that's my personal current research project, is to learn more about that. Wouldn't be at all surprised if in the dream state, that somehow our minds are open and receptive to connecting to all kinds of things outside of ourselves. And I think that's a wonderful and important thing. But it's not what we want to do in meditation. So what can happen in meditation is you can get into that state of suspension between the dream state and the wakeful state and begin to have visions and images. And you don't want to do that. Because that's not going to lead you where this path leads. Do that when you take up other practices.
But that is the question for me. How do you bring this together? What you describe as the clear, focused, logical, one-pointed mind, what we train in meditation, right, is the left brain. So what do we do with the creative mind who works on imagination and associative images and daydreaming and is that separated then from your practice, or how do you do that?
No. What we're trying to do is we're trying to bring, you use the right side, left side. We're not trying to be in some left brain, logical, analytical, linear place. We're also trying to experience the holistic present. What we would do is we would like to have both hemispheres of our brain fully contributing to our conscious awareness. And as a matter of fact, how is it that you can be aware of the mind as the mind is being aware of something else? I mean, it's difficult to explain unless you realize that we've actually got two minds to work with. Right? So we want to use both of them. We're not trying to be exclusively left brain, analytical, linear. And those are all terms which accurately describe certain functions that are predominantly developed on one side of the brain. But let's remember that those words have other meanings. Okay? So, when we are dreaming, the mind is excessively associational, especially when we're having ordinary dreams. When we have what we call the big dreams, it might be a completely detailed universe and a great span of experience, and it's all very integrated, just the way when it is when we're awake, it fits together. But most of the time when we're asleep and dreaming, the problem is that we're way too associational. You know, and the teapot turns into a frog, and your mother turns into the next door neighbor, and you know, you put something down and it disappears, and you walk out the door and you're in a different world. And, you know, it's gone too far the other direction. Right? So, when I say that in the hypnagogic space and in dreaming that we've lost linearity, I'm not referring to that left brain linearity so much as I am the consistency that links in some kind of meaningful way one perception to another. That there's more connection between them than just a superficial resemblance of pattern. Because when your mind is just doing this free association, you've seen those intelligence tests that, you know, they have A is to B, C is to D, you know, and they give you all these examples. And of course, the testing to see your ability to recognize the patterns and the similarity of the patterns in some sense. But the connections themselves, even though A is to B has a definite recognizable resemblance to C is to D, you know, it may be recognizable, but it is definitely not meaningful. And they do that on purpose on the tests, because they're trying to test one particular function of your mind. So if they made it meaningful, then they wouldn't know whether you were answering it correctly, whether your mind had been able to discern the correct answer on the basis of the pattern resemblance or on the intrinsic meaning of the statements. And that's the problem. That big dreams are meaningful and consistent. They have a coherency to them that our ordinary little dreams don't have. So what we're cultivating in meditation isn't just linearity. It's more of a whole brain, holistic. It's not devoid of logic, but it's not confined to logic. It's creative. And what I was talking about earlier, let's call these kind of shamanic visionary states. I think probably a well-developed shamanic visionary state has much more in common with big dreams and may very well represent some sort of, it's accessing some other, what word to use? It's accessing some other access of mindness, aspect of mindness than what we're normally familiar with. And when I come to understand that better, I'll let you know what I've discovered. But my point is, these shamanic visionary states, I'm not taking anything away from their value or their importance, but they're not what we're after in meditation. And it is a kind of trap that you can get into if in your meditation you start having these visionary experiences. Then that's all you want to do. It's the same thing that happens when you're meditating and you start to have these great insights into what this means and psychological insights that this is why I am the way I am, this is why other people are the way they are. they start out as great insights, but eventually they end up being trivia that your mind entertains itself with. You know, but it can be very addicting. And it's the same thing is true with these shamanic visionary kinds of experiences. They're not what the meditation practice is about. Doesn't take anything away from them, but they're places in doing some different kind of practice. But you can get into these states and sustain them. And that's what I want to just point out here is that there are, of the subtler degrees of dullness, there are some that can be sustained. And they can mimic single-pointedness. A state of subtle dullness can reduce the amount of distraction that's present in your mind so that you feel like you're very single-pointed. And it feels, as almost all dullness does, it feels pleasant. It feels very pleasant. And so if that's present, then you can feel like, well, gee, sounds just like what it says in the book. I've got single-pointedness, and now I'm feeling joy and happiness. And, you know. So that's what makes it a danger. As I say, it can be useful if you're experiencing monkey mind. If you can enter into that milder state of dullness, you can settle the mind down. And then you can work on brightening the energy level of the mind up again afterwards. So, I don't know, have I painted a clear enough picture of subtle and
fun? Just one more thing. Yeah. So, I don't have the Zen lurch very much, but what I do, it seems fairly frequently, I can tell when my perception of the breathing is kind of disappearing, or
yes.
It seems like it's very far away. And so, but is that the same technique that I need to mm-hmm. wake myself up by whatever
yes.
means necessary?
Yes, exactly the same technique. You just bring yourself out of it, do whatever you need to. You know what? And what will happen, a really important part of practicing with dullness is coming to recognize dullness. But what that means is you're also coming to recognize what it means to be fully alert, fully awake, you know, and fully present. And you come to recognize the feeling of that. And then what you want to do, you know, as you come to know that, is when you sit down to meditate, you want the level of your awareness to only increase. At the very least, stay the same, or increase. But you don't want your level of awareness to decrease, to diminish. That's the development of dullness. And so you practice towards being able to recognize when you start to lose your edge and to bring it back. Of course, beyond that, you come to the point where as you sit in meditation, the power of your mindful awareness increases. And it increases like the strength of a muscle does. The more you use it, the stronger it is, and the more endurance, the longer you can sustain it at a higher level, a more intense level of awareness. And also, like a muscle, you know, if you do enough curls with a weight, then when you go out in the world and you have to pick up a bag of groceries, well, you've got exactly the same strength. And it's the same way. The power of mindful awareness that you concentrate, that you cultivate when sitting, when you go out in the world to interact with other people in difficult situations and so forth, you have that power of mindful awareness at your disposal. It's available to you to serve your needs. What I'd like to do right now is to share with you a little model. It's a very ancient model, but it's helpful in understanding dullness. It's helpful in understanding distraction, both distraction and dullness. It's helpful in understanding what I mean when I say the power of mindful awareness. And that is that you normally experience your consciousness as being continuous, right? And you normally experience that you can be consciously aware of a number of things at the same time. You can be entertaining a thought, listening to my voice, hearing the evaporative cooler, you know, feeling pressure in your ankle, all at the same time, right? So, but as a model for consciousness, let's imagine that it's made up of many discrete moments of consciousness. Each one is very small. And that the reason that they appear to be continuous is that they are so small, they're like the frames on a movie projector. They go by so quickly that we're not aware of the gaps between them. So think of your, over a period of a minute, as being a very, very large number of very small moments of consciousness, sort of like the beads on this mala. Okay? Now, in each moment of consciousness, consciousness arises and it either takes an object or it doesn't. And then consciousness passes away. And then the next moment of consciousness arises and either takes an object or it doesn't. And then the next one, and the next one, and so forth. And so they're like the frames in a movie. Got the picture? Okay. Now, I said they either take an object or they don't. And in this model, which is a very ancient one, they describe these as either perceiving or non-perceiving moments of consciousness. So you've got two kinds. Okay. Now, in a period of time, let's say this is a period of, between my fingers is a period of 30 seconds. You have to imagine many more beads on my mullet than there really are. But an interval of time, okay. Now, there can be scattered in this interval quite a few non-perceiving moments of consciousness, and they won't be noticed as long as there's not too many of them together in a row. Okay? So, for example, every fifth bead could represent a non-perceiving moment of consciousness, and you wouldn't really notice them. But if there were five beads in a row that were non-perceiving moments of consciousness, it might produce an effect that you would be aware of. Okay? Now, also in this time interval, some of these moments of consciousness might be taking a thought process that you're having as object. So maybe you're thinking about what you're going to have to eat when you get home if this guy ever shuts up. And at the same time, you're listening to what I'm saying and you're hearing the evaporative cooler and you're feeling the pressure in your ankle, which means that in this interval here, some of these moments of consciousness are taking your thought as object. Some of them are taking my words as object. Some of them are taking the ambient sounds as object. Some of them are taking bodily sensations as object. Which gives you the impression in this interval of time of being aware of all of these things at the same time. Okay. Then, what does it mean to say that we keep our breath at the focal point of our awareness while in the periphery of our awareness, thoughts come and go, sensations come and go, sounds come and go? Well, what that means is that the majority of the perceiving moments of consciousness in this interval are on the sensations of the breath. And there's enough of those kinds of moments there that we appear to be continuously aware of the breath. But there are enough of those moments of consciousness that are attending to thoughts and sounds and bodily sensations that we seem to be, we're kind of aware of them too. They seem to be in the background of our awareness because there's fewer of these moments of consciousness that are attending to them. So that's the nature of focusing the attention on one thing and having other things present at the same time. as subtle distractions. Yes?
I was just wondering, how long is a moment of consciousness thought to last?
There's different theories and versions about that. Amongst those who've never experienced moments of consciousness, there's all kinds of amazing, ridiculous, absurd numbers. Okay. Amongst those who experience them in meditation, they usually give estimates that are of the order of about 30 to 60 hertz. And neurophysiologists would suggest to you that the closest neurological correlate to consciousness is an approximately 40 hertz frequency that is referred to as the binding frequency. And interestingly enough, this is where, when you're perceiving something through different sensory modalities, then the different parts of the brain involved are synchronized at this 40 hertz, and that's why it's called the binding frequency. So my suggestion is it's probably somewhere around 40 hertz, maybe variable, maybe in the 30 to 60 hertz range, you know, and it may possibly be subject to variation due to things that we don't know. That's totally, what I told you is just totally theoretical. But it's adequate. It is adequate to account for everything that this model purports to account for. Now let's go to the non-perceiving moments of consciousness. Okay. We might wonder, in a normal interval of consciousness, how many non-perceiving moments of consciousness are scattered through there. Okay. And we might say, well, when I'm in total anesthesia, it's probably pretty near to 100%. And when I'm in the deepest stages of sleep, it's probably a very high percentage. As you may know, the deepest stages of sleep are not totally unconscious, and even very often when people are awakened from them, they will have, they'll be able to report vague dreamlike experiences. So it would seem from that that in deep sleep, it may not be quite as high a proportion as in under total anesthesia, but it's some very high proportion of non-perceiving moments of consciousness. So let's just for simplicity's sake say when they're just about all non-perceiving, we're either unconscious or deeply asleep. Okay? What would be the other end of the spectrum? If you examine your own experience, if you listen to the accounts of other human beings that we have the good fortune to have access to. It's interesting, 10,000 years ago, the only experiences we know are our own and those of our immediate neighbors that live maybe within 20 miles. But now we know about the experiences of all kinds of people all over the world. And what we know, some of you from your own experience, maybe you've been in a very dangerous situation and your mind has popped into a different state where it seemed like everything was happening in slow motion, and you could track everything that was going on. Right? You had those experiences? I've had those experiences. A large percentage of normal people at one time or another have had that kind of experience in their life. And so you know what your mind is capable of. So that would be like an interval where there's very, very few. The only way you can account for that degree of awareness, a slowing down of time, and being able to track many different processes at once, is you're not wasting any of these moments of consciousness. They're all perceiving moments. There's no non-perceiving moments of consciousness. So we can see then that we have at one end of the scale are almost all non-perceiving. And the other end of the scale, they're almost all perceiving moments of consciousness. Athletes get into the zone. Baseball batters and pitchers, for example. A batter who gets into the zone sees the entire process of the windup and the pitch and the release in a kind of slow motion. And there is time not for him to consciously think and process and plan, but there's time for his nervous system and his body to respond and make whatever microscopic fine-tuned adjustments need to be made to the movement of the bat so it actually connects with the ball. And an athlete that can do that is in the zone. Well-known basketball player, anyway, it doesn't matter. I wasn't too long ago, he was on television, he was talking about being in the zone. Somebody was saying, you know, how do you, he said, when I'm on the court, everything is happening so slow that it's easy for me to do what I do. So this is the other end. We're not wasting any moments of consciousness. Well, looking at that scale, where would you say you are most of the time in your ordinary daily life? Middle at best, huh? And sometimes less than that. And you think about it, oh yeah, I go through my day, sometimes I space out lots of non-perceiving moments of consciousness. And other times it's like, I'm really present, and lots of perceiving moments of consciousness. So, you sit down to meditate. Let's assume, just, I mean, we're making this up for the sake of discussion. I don't know that it's how accurate this is. But let's assume that your normal waking state of consciousness as you approach the cushion is about 50-50 perceiving and non-perceiving moments of consciousness. That's what you bring to the cushion with you. And you sit down and you begin to meditate. Right? You can go either way. You can have more, you can have the proportion of non-perceiving moments of consciousness increase or decrease. If you start paying attention to the sensations of the breath, and you start noticing exactly when the in-breath begins and ends, and the out-breath begins and ends, and how many different changes in sensation there are in the course of an in-breath. The air starts out cool and strong, and then there's a sharp sensation, and then gradually becomes softer, and you know, whatever it happens for you, you might be able to distinguish four or five or six different changes in sensation in the course of an in-breath. You certainly couldn't do that when you began. You've got to be recruiting more moments of consciousness to your perceptual awareness in order to have that experience. And if you keep doing that, you're going to train the mind to operate at a higher level of awareness. As dullness, as you sit there and your mind starts to get bored with this and tired of this, it might start sinking into dullness. And so as you have fewer moments of consciousness, fewer perceiving moments of consciousness, and more non-perceiving moments, the appearance of your breath becomes more distant, a little more vague, a little fuzzier, right? Not so clear. There's getting to be more non-perceiving moments of consciousness, and maybe they're strung together in longer chains, which makes it a whole lot easier for some other unrelated but similar mental image to insert itself into the chain. And so now your breath gradually becomes what's happening with your body when you're swimming. Right? So you see how that happens. So if you use this moments of consciousness model, you see you can have a way of understanding distraction and dullness both. You can see that you can have dullness and distraction at the same time. But the more focused your mind is, the fewer perceiving moments of consciousness are going somewhere else. And the more alert and awake you are, the more fully aware you are, the fewer of the moments of consciousness that are present are the non-perceiving kind. So we want to move in the direction of more perceiving than non-perceiving moments, and more of those perceiving moments being taking the meditation object as the object of consciousness in the moment. Yes?
So it sounds like when you were saying six different sensations or observations about your breath.
Yes.
So some of them might be feeling sensations. Some of them might be reasoning, this is what's happening now, so, or thoughts.
Yes.
And I guess maybe even unconscious of, I have to take a breath now, you know.
Yes. Right.
So it sounds like you're not in one continuum of feeling or of, you're in different
That's right.
thought modes. And then is that what you meant when you said the 40 hertz, that your mind is just really balanced in these? Is that?
Well, the way that we normally, if I understand what you're asking correctly, assuming that, yeah, there, say there's 40 moments of consciousness per second, okay, that our normal perceiving of a variety of things at the same time is because some of the moments of consciousness in that series are devoted to each of those different things. And if they're all fairly evenly balanced, then it feels as though we're paying equal attention to all of them. Whereas if we are focused on one of them and only aware of the others to a lesser degree, then that means that that one, that there's a majority, you know, not all in one block, but more in the whole sequence and maybe longer chains of them in the sequence that are on that primary object.
So that's why if, like, I'm all in the sensation feeling, I can, you know, get lost in that.
Yes.
And if I can focus on, you know, different aspects of the breathing, that's really helpful. Thanks.
So I think this is a useful model. I wouldn't want you to say that, oh, this is the gospel, this is the way it really, this is reality, this is the way it really is.
And then it slows down too, so I can see where it might slow down if you're indifferent.
Yeah.
At least from the feeling point of view, things start to move uncontrollably and forward.
Larry?
I was wondering, does this model have anything to do with the holding pattern idea that you talked about once before?
I don't remember which holding pattern.
You hold in memory, short-term memory, you know, the last few seconds of what's happened, and that sort of creates an illusion of the world.
It does, yes. Because if you think about your normal perceptual experience, and I'll use a very familiar example, a melody. Somebody plays a melody on the piano at a normal speed, you know, it might take three notes, four notes, but you pretty quickly you recognize, that's, you know, and then you identify, you give the name to it. But it's the relationship between them that allows you to identify it. Because you could hear those same notes one at a time, say separated by 30 seconds, and it'd be impossible to figure out that melody was. Right? Even if the gap wasn't always 30 seconds, but the gap was proportional to, you know, I mean, so to recognize the sound of a motorcycle on the street outside is the same thing. The individual components of the sound arise and pass away. The only way we can assemble them together to have a recognizable construct and put the label, you know, noisy motorcycle on it, is if the mind holds enough of them that it can assemble them together into recognizable units. And so, this is something that our minds do, and it's something when you meditate, you'll discover. The level of your mindful awareness becomes high, and you are sitting in meditation, or you're walking in meditation, and you become aware that every single sound reverberates in your mind, and this is what allows them, after one has passed away, this is what allows your mind to assemble them together and to extract a meaningful pattern, meaningful information.
It almost sounds like certain faculty of the mind is like looking at that string of beads and like taking a snapshot of it.
Yeah, exactly. And this little theory that I gave you is one, I said it was very old. It's from it's called Abhidhamma, which means what it is a, it's a philosophical analysis of the Buddha's teaching, trying to generate a metaphysics from things that he taught. And in the Abhidhamma, with a further development of the moments of consciousness theory, it